Off we go again. It's podcast time with usual suspects, journalists Leo Devine and Rosie Dawson. And me, I'm Hannah Scott-Joint, and this is the Religion Media Centre podcast. Hello, team. So what's caught your eye this week? Rosie, how about you first?
Well, I've been gripped by the midterms.
Oh, goodness.
And have been enjoying hearing that Donald Trump is shouting and screaming about not necessarily the Democrat results, but the results of Republicans who he supported.
And blaming everybody else.
I don't know if you saw the advert for Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who is now Trump's arch nemesis. The voiceover proclaimed that on the eighth day, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, "I need a protector." So God made a fighter. And this fighter is Ron DeSantis. And the video went on saying, you know, God said. I mean, very reminiscent of the Genesis creation story. And it's funny that this is meant to appeal precisely to those people who would take the Bible as literally true and therefore might be expected to object to this. But actually, they love it. And it plays into this very conservative idea that their man is a messiah or a savior, which, of course, is what was used of Donald Trump. The journalist Sarah Posner says that the ad's message is that Democrats, liberals and the deep state will take away America's freedom, but God has sent DeSantis to save the people. And so whatever he does next will also be portrayed as just what God intended. So watch this space for the Republican race. And yeah, it looks all very interesting and a bit familiar.
Did you see that Donald has nicknamed him Ronda Sanctimonious?
Yeah. He has got a good turn of phrase sometimes.
He certainly has. Leo.
Yeah, well, I was reading the Catholic Universe. Now, that paper for me, growing up in Manchester, my parents, working class Catholics, got the Universe every single week. It was part of our Thursday, I think it was. But this week in the Universe, Catholic Bishop Paul McAleenan, who's been appointed Bishop for Migrants and Refugees. Did you know there was a Bishop for Migrants and Refugees? He's called on the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, to dial down her rhetoric on migrants. In a stinging attack, Bishop Paul has said, "It's imperative that everyone refrains from inflammatory language that undermines people's humanity and creates tensions between communities. We need to remember that migrants and refugees are human beings made in the image of God." So certainly the Catholic Church coming out very strongly against Suella Braverman's stance on migrants.
Absolutely. Well, as we head towards Remembrance Sunday, I was reading that a Sikh daily prayer book is going to be given to British military personnel to keep them close to their faith. And this move has been inspired by the image of a Sikh soldier with a prayer book in the trenches during World War One. It's called the Nitnem Gutgar Sahib, a collection of Sikh hymns and prayers. And it comes with a waterproof and tearproof cover, one of which is bound in a camouflage design. And Major Daljinder Singh Verdi said that the words give discipline, moral and spiritual strength, and that when they first joined the military, and this astounds me, many Sikhs in the UK had simply been given Christian prayer books. But this is now a recognition of the 0.1% of the forces who are Sikh. And of course, many Sikh soldiers fought with the Allied forces in the First and Second World Wars. I don't know about you, but I'm kind of amazed and slightly horrified that they've only been given a prayer book and a Bible up till now. It just seems absolutely basic.
It's a lovely story, but yes, as you say, incredible, really. And I think it's interesting for Remembrance Weekend, if we put it that way, an Armistice Day on Friday, that we forget the Commonwealth soldiers very often who fought alongside the Allies and died.
Absolutely. There was much, much more diversity in the Allied forces than people maybe recognise. Just a reminder, the Religion Media Centre puts out a daily news bulletin, including this week, some of those stories that we've talked about and more, which you can have sent straight to your inbox first thing each weekday morning. It can be the first thing you look at when you wake up. If you don't subscribe already, you can do so via the website, religionmediacentre.org.uk. So as we record, the United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP27, is halfway through in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was blunt and clear in his opening statement. Humanity has a choice, cooperate or perish, he said, adding that we are on the highway to climate hell.
Well, the faith communities are there, of course, out in force, including one group which wants to introduce an international law against ecocide or ecocide. So I'm really pleased that we've got with us today Pelle Thiel, who's the co-founder of the End Ecocide Law in Sweden and coordinator of the Faith for Ecocide Law, and Olivia Fuchs, who's the coordinator of Ecodharma Network and a research fellow at the Centre for Applied Buddhism. So Pelle, just tell us, how is it ecocide or ecocide? Which should I say?
Oh, I think you should tell me. I'm not a native English speaker, so what's best in your mouth?
Well, I'm just going to mix and match and confuse everybody. Okay, so just tell us about the origination of this idea of a law against ecocide. It fits within, or you'd like it to fit within, UN international law. Is that right?
Yeah, what we're working for is to add ecocide. I say ecocide then. As an international crime at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. And there, currently, there are four crimes in the Rome Statute, which is a document regulating the ICC. And they are collectively called the crimes against peace. So that is crimes against humanity, war crimes, crimes of aggression, and genocide, and there you get the parallel to ecocide. So we want to add a fifth crime against peace, as ecocide currently is the consequences of the ongoing ecocide is greatly increasing the risk for the other crimes.
But how do you define ecocide? Because it's very hard to get people to agree when aggression meets the threshold of genocide. So, you know, how far do you have to get before a particular action would meet the threshold to be considered ecocide?
Yeah, that would be a case for the court in the end. But since last year, we have a definition of a crime of ecocide, which is from an independent panel of top legal experts, and it reads that ecocide means unlawful or wanton acts committed with knowledge that there is a substantial likelihood of severe and either widespread or long-term damage to the environment being caused by those acts. And this definition is really well connected to existing international law. So those terms are coming from international law. But in the end, it will be up to courts to define, I mean, to set the limits of ecocide. But it will be the most destructive acts.
And Olivia, you come at this from a Buddhist point of view. What's your response to the question of ecocide?
Well, we completely endorse it. And I think Pelle's just created an amazing book, and there is a Buddhist response to that as well by one of my colleagues, or a couple of my colleagues. As Buddhists, we believe absolutely in the interconnection and interdependence of all life. And we're also aware that we are completely reliant on the natural, on nature. We are part of nature. And so it's important for us human beings as well to actually do this. It's nature in itself has its own value, and we should absolutely respect all living life forms and not see it as a hierarchy of the human beings being the most important, who are then able to just extract and use the rest of nature and of the planet. So we completely endorse it, and it's very much a belief of Buddhists. And I think there is also a big tradition of Buddhists protecting there were Buddhist monks in Vietnam who protected the trees and actually ordained them in order to protect them from being cut down. So there is a big Buddhist tradition about understanding how important all life forms are and how we are entirely interconnected, and we can't see ourselves as separate and just extract and use at the rate that we're going now.
I'm interested that the groups that are supporting the idea of the law, you've got the main religions, people from the main religions, Pelle, but you've also got indigenous communities, the Maoris, the Sami, and so on. And I'm wondering why this idea is particularly important for them in a legal way.
So indigenous traditions, they have the idea of nature and the living world as sacred, as a really founding element, and also like a daily practice in their cultures, something that we in the Western world have largely lost, I think. And so they are really leading the space here. And to them, the law isn't mainly something that is like institutionalized by humans, but the law is in the land, it's in the landscape, and humans are to align with that law. And that is something that we who are living in a largely institutionalized culture have lost. But still, you know, the law of nature is still there and is still coming to get us if we don't abide. And that's why we have to have international conferences now dealing with the consequences of us breaking those laws.
To enshrine ecocide in international law would need enormous international buy-in, wouldn't it? How likely is that?
Yeah, personally, I think it's inevitable, or I think we will have a civilizational collapse. And I have been working on this issue for 10 years, and people always said to me, well, that's nice, that's important, but it's actually impossible. And the development since this definition that I mentioned was presented a little over a year ago has been phenomenal. So there are now over 25 states where there are discussions on governmental or parliamentary level on the law of ecocide. So it's actually, you know, it's much faster than we had anticipated.
And what specifically can faith leaders bring to this? Why them?
Faith leaders are incredibly important, I find. One thing is that they gather, they have the ear of so many people. So they really reach out. But also because faith leaders have this understanding of morals and values and existential issues. And when we are having these international conferences like the COP meeting in Egypt, we are dealing with emissions, with the consequences of our actions, while we should be discussing this as existential issues. And that's what faith leaders have the capacity to do. So I think it's really very vital that they are involved in this conversation.
Do you think there's still a huge amount of ignorance? I'm thinking of a bishop from South Sudan who we interviewed at the Lambeth Conference this year. The majority of his diocese is underwater, absolutely underwater. That was a surprise to me, I'm ashamed to say, and I'm sure it was a surprise to many people. What do you make of that? Are people just not speaking loudly enough? Are we closing our ears to all of this?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think we have been shouting for so many years, but yes, since we are all part of a system that are now set up to be treating nature as we are, we have like interests in shutting our ears. And that's why when we are talking about, well, there is a way out, we can collectively change the rules that in a way that would apply to the most powerful actors globally. That brings a lot of hope to people. So when we start speaking about the possibility of ecocide law, which is really an issue that people are not aware of, then that brings a lot of hope and action in my experience.
Olivia, I wonder what soundings are you getting from your colleagues who are at the COP at the mood there, whether anything is going to change, whether there's any point in being there. I mean, it's easy, isn't it, to feel a little bit despondent when we find out that only 29 of the countries that were there last year have done what they said they were going to do.
Well, so first of all, I was going to say we need to really educate the media as well. And I think this podcast is great in bringing up the importance of these issues. And also not to give up hope in the COP particularly, that we can collaborate and that it's very important for civil society to influence what's happening. There was a great book launch, I gather, Pella, of your book, of Ecocide. So I think it's really about education and spreading the word and changing attitudes and really understanding the, like you said, Guterres and a lot of the opening speeches were very strong, much stronger than before. So there's hope in that, that things are changing. Whether people do anything about it is very difficult, but that's why you need to bring in international laws.
And one of the things that you're particularly advocating for is this thing we're starting to hear a lot about, a kind of sort of reparations, a sort of loss and damage fund through new and additional funding. Do you think that that's got any traction?
Well, I think, again, it's very interesting that the developing countries actually have put that on the agenda, and it's changed. It's now really on the agenda. Again, difficult to know how to, in a way, force the developed countries or the global north to actually add this. But there are easy ways of doing it. We can make polluters pay. That's one of the sort of ways of trying to do it. Doesn't mean that the countries themselves have to do it, but it's the polluters and the big polluting companies. There are lots of actual ways that we could solve these issues and create a loss and damage fund, which is so important because, as we know, Pakistan is still underwater. I've just heard from Leo about in Sudan, which I didn't know about. There's so many sort of terrible issues and things already happening around the world. It's not in the future. So we have to have this loss and damage fund. And we in the global north are responsible for this because we're the main emitters. We've historically been the main emitters. And so we need to really take responsibility for supporting countries that are suffering and the communities that are suffering most and have done least to do that.
I mean, I was hearing about a family friend whose farm in Australia is underwater. I mean, you know, this isn't just something that is happening in developing countries. And I just wonder whether now those kind of disasters are happening in countries that you might call developed, yeah. Actually, that is almost, I mean, all terribly what needs to happen in order for people to wake up to that. You know, they're in their second once in a century flood in 10 years. And you know, that whole area of Victoria is underwater.
I think you're completely right. And I think this summer, with all the different the heat waves, the extreme heats, the floods, the fires, I think that is making a difference. But, you know, we need to make it quick enough. But when there's the will, then things can change quite quickly, I believe.
So, Pella, just finally, I mean, I was interested in the fact that you used the word hope and that faith traditions carry hope. You're right. They all do. But to be honest, even from within a faith tradition, hope feels like quite a challenge at the moment. So I'm just wondering how you, I mean, Olivia and Pella, but maybe Pella first, how do you stay hopeful?
Because it's the only thing I can do to be a responsible human being. And I love the contribution that comes from Olivia's organization, which is called A Treasure House of Possibilities. In this book, Faith Voices for Ecocide Law. And I want to point out that it's now downloadable for anyone as a PDF on our website. So please take part and read it. That, you know, if we view humans as these creative and loving and wonderful beings, we know that we can do better. We know that it's a possibility to live in harmony with each other and with nature. And this treasure house of possibilities is opened when we find a way to regulate ourselves and steward ourselves collectively in relationship to the living world. And I think that's perfectly possible. And we haven't even started yet, almost. But ecocide law is a start, and it's a powerful start, and it's a possible one.
And Olivia, hope for you?
Absolutely. It's a daily practice. I have to every day challenge myself to transform my despair into hope. So that's my spiritual practice. And also, like Pella said, it's collaboration. That gives me so much hope, collaborating with other faiths. And tomorrow, I don't know if you know, but there's the climate march for COP27. And I'd really say, please come and join. We're meeting as faith groups together as well. And we are our main ask is for loss and damage fund and reparations.
Mm-hmm. And there's one in London and there's two others.
Loads all over the country. So you could just look it up. Climate Justice, I think, is the website. I'll quickly look it up.
Olivia, Pella, thank you so much for speaking to us about that and expanding our knowledge, certainly. Now, last month, an independent Anglican denomination appointed four new bishops in the UK. Got to say, it was news to me that there was even an independent Anglican denomination operating here in the UK. Journalist Tim Wyatt is hopefully going to explain. Now, Tim, this is called the Anglican Network in Europe, isn't it? Who are they? And I mean, without wanting, why are they? What? Just explain a bit to us about it.
Yeah, they're not very well known outside of kind of nerdy church circles, but the Anglican Network in Europe is basically quite a new network of approximately about 35 churches, which are mostly in England, but also there's a handful in Scotland, Wales, and some on the continent as well. And these are Anglican churches so that they follow the kind of historic Christian tradition of Anglicanism, but they are not part of the official Anglican movement worldwide. So the ones in England are not part of the Church of England, and the ones in Scotland are not part of the Scottish Episcopal Church, which is the official kind of Anglican church. So these are, on the whole, people who have broken away from mainstream Anglican churches because they are more conservative theologically and they disagree quite strongly, mostly around sexuality concerns.
So the clergy who are in this network, have they been clergy in the Church of England, the Episcopal Church? I mean, is that their background, or have some of them come from outside that completely?
So most of them have been ordained originally within the Church of England and normally served for a period of time before kind of seceding or quitting or whatever you want, breaking away. But actually, what is interesting about the Anglican network in Europe is that unlike there's a few other kind of tiny splinter Anglican churches already that have been around for a while. But what the Anglican network in Europe are doing is they are now ordaining their own ministers from scratch. So they're not just a kind of repository of schismatics, as it were, but they are trying to set themselves up as an independent kind of separate church. And so they are starting their own new churches, and they are training always men, young men, to be ministers, to be the vicars, who have never actually kind of gone through the C of E process at all.
And who's funding them? Because money has to come from somewhere for this.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's not entirely clear. I've asked them in the past and they are kind of vague about the funding sources. I think a significant proportion of the money, as it does with Anglican churches, kind of mainstream ones, comes from the congregation and giving in the church. But what is interesting as well is that they are very deeply connected and meshed in with the global GAFCON movement, which people might have heard of before. And GAFCON is a mixture of both kind of official mainstream Anglicans elsewhere in the world, especially in Africa and Asia, but also some other breakaway churches in America and Canada, who again are much more conservative and kind of acting as an alternative center of gravity to kind of Canterbury and the traditional Lambeth Conference kind of structures of Anglicanism.
Now, it's a complex story, isn't it, Tim? But we should say and give you a plug, you've done a wonderful article for the Religion Media Centre, which unpicks all of it. But the significant thing here, for those who have a theological brain, is that by ordaining bishops, that's a very significant step, because people believe in this sense of apostolic succession, don't they? That this goes right back to the early church. And once you have bishops, then you really start that momentum for a new church. And well, from my point of view, and from a lot of people's point of view, that's quite dangerous when they have quite difficult views on things like same-sex marriage. As you say, it's quite a right-wing view, a very, very evangelical view of the church, speaking of personal opinion here. But that momentum now starts. Once you ordain bishops, that starts.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Leo. It's a really, they see it as a very kind of important staging post on kind of growing and developing the network to ultimately in, you know, maybe 5-10 years becoming, you know, its own kind of denomination in its own right. Because a core tenet of Anglicanism is that you don't have independent ministers. Like, there are lots of other evangelicals in this country who kind of are happy to act independently, but they say no, part of being Anglican means you have to be knitted into this historic chain of succession that goes all the way back to the original apostles and Jesus himself. And so they had to find a way. They couldn't just appoint their own bishops. They had to find a way of connecting themselves into that historic Anglican succession, which they did through the kind of GAFCON connection. So it was the official, you know, Archbishop of Nigeria, the quote unquote real mainstream Archbishop of Nigeria, who is in communion with Justin Welby and the rest of the C of E. He came along to this service in Hull and consecrated three of these ministers as bishops. And what is striking about that is that he and a few other archbishops who came along, Kenya and Rwanda, they boycotted the official Lambeth conference also held in the UK just a few months ago. So they're turning their backs on Justin Welby, yeah. But they're putting their weight behind these breakaways.
In communion and yet.
Exactly.
I haven't heard much reaction to this story from the establishment, Tim. I mean, there seems to be a deafening silence about it.
Yeah, you're right. I spoke with one of the new bishops and who leads one of the longest established kind of breakaway churches, a guy called Lee McMunn, and I asked him, what is your relationship like with the kind of main, are you in conversations with your archbishops? And he said, no, nothing like that. You know, they collaborate with local pastors in their own towns where they feel they're able to, but there's not really any kind of top level dialogue going on. And he was really keen to steer the conversation away from the idea that they only exist, in his words, as a lifeboat for people bailing out of the Church of England. I think they very strongly feel like we're not just a repository of conservatives who've got frustrated, but we want to be our own independent thing and stand on our own two feet.
Although we cannot ignore the sexuality issue, obviously. We talked last week about the bishops in the Church of England meeting to talk about the possibility of same-sex marriage and blessings in church, and several bishops broke cover to say that they feel the time has now come for change. It must be fair to say that the Anglican Network in Europe are getting their ducks in a row at this point in the expectation, whether or not they say we're not a lifeboat for people defecting, but, you know, General Synod vote in February, they must be expecting that people, or hoping that people, are going to defect to them, churches, clergy.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, they wouldn't dispute that clearly a large number of their members and churches are Anglican vicars and congregations which quit in kind of protest sometimes years ago, long before we even got to this point. So clearly, if and when the Church of England does have some kind of accommodation or changes its doctrine on marriage, as we expect it probably will next year, there is no doubt that they expect a kind of the trickle of defectors to increase to a stream, and maybe even more. Though again, McMahon kind of insisted they weren't expecting a kind of flood and kind of explosive growth from that way at all.
I don't know whether it's the right comparison, but the church has been here before, hasn't it? Insofar as I remember covering as a reporter some of the first women deacons being appointed and then women priests. And there was all of this talk about a breakaway church and schism. And in the end, the accommodation was the Bishop of Ebbsfleet, wasn't it? The flying bishops, in a way to keep those people in. Maybe they should have left.
What's really interesting is I spoke to a kind of church historian of evangelicalism, and he said, you know, there are these handful of previous breakaway movements. One of them is called the Church of England bracket continuing, which came into being in the 1990s during those debates over women priests. But it's four churches and two ministers, and it's never gone more than that.
But it still exists.
It still exists to this day. You can find its website. There's a thing called the Free Church of England, which came about in the 1840s and has been limping along ever since.
So just finally, what's the master plan?
For the breakaways, you mean? Their master plan is very clearly modelled on something called the Anglican Church in North America, which people might have heard about. So this all, it kind of happened 20 years ago in the States when the Episcopal Church, the official Anglican Church in America, started taking a more liberal turn and was famously ordained the first kind of openly gay bishop in Gene Robinson. And conservatives basically broke away there, went through a very expensive and complicated series of battles to reclaim their churches and set up this thing called the Anglican Church in North America, which now exists as a kind of parallel, fully fledged series of dioceses. And that is very clearly what ANIE in Europe are aiming to replicate, also overseen and knitted into the GAFCON network internationally.
Tim, thank you so much for disentangling that for us. And yes, as we said, you've done a great article on the RMC website. Thanks so much. Just before we end this week's podcast, Leo, any quirks from you this week?
Well, I was struck by eminent neurosurgeon, Dr. Eben Alexander. Have you heard of him?
No.
A very rational and respected brain surgeon. But he believes he experienced the afterlife and heaven during a 7-day coma during which he was fighting for his life. The key thing is that he says, being a brain surgeon, he reviewed all of the charts once he came to. There was no way that his brain, he says, could have experienced a dream or hallucination. So he's now written a book called Proof of Heaven, a neurosurgeon's journey. And it's also returned him to faith, something he'd lost years before as a Methodist. And his conclusion is, there is meaning to our lives and there is evidence that consciousness survives death. And by the way, heaven's quite a nice place.
Oh, good.
He told us that.
Good. It's good, yeah. I'm happy about that.
Good. That is a very nice way to end. Well, that is this week's Religion Media Centre podcast. Do let us know what you think and share it widely. But for now, from Leo, Rosie and myself, thanks for spending some time with us. We'll be back next Friday. Bye for now. The Religion Media Centre is an impartial and independent organisation providing an expert resource for the media and other interested parties to help the reporting and understanding of religion and beliefs. You can find news, fact sheets, briefings and lots more on the website at religionmediacentre.org.uk, where you can also sign up for a daily roundup of stories about religion and belief from the UK and around the world straight to your inbox. If you'd like to support the podcast and the work we do, contributions are very welcome. Thank you if you do, have or will. It all helps us continue to tell the stories that matter, and it's hugely appreciated.